All right, so you're listening to 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch, and you are listening to Radio Naturopath. And for the next hour, you'll get some great information about a bunch of different topics, which will be lots of fun, and I'll be happy to share that information with you. We would love for you to participate in the show. Really, this is a call-in show, and we would like for you to ask questions. So the number to call is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. You can also text at that same number, 860-486-9487. So we've been getting some questions from the internet and from Facebook and stuff like that. By the way, I do have a Facebook page if you'd like to check it out. It's Fran Storch, ND, Naturopathic Physician, Radio Naturopath. And you can like it on Facebook. And then one of the things you'll find there is podcasts of this show. You can also, of course, find podcasts of this show at whus.org. So if you don't get to listen to the whole show because you're driving somewhere or you're busy and you're doing other stuff and you miss part of it, you can go on demand. Last night I turned on the TV half an hour into a show. I said, I'm not going to watch that right now. I want to watch the whole thing. And I decided to watch it on demand at a later time. Well, you can do that here too. But I invite you to listen because we're going to do sound bites of information today. So in the tradition of Passover, I'm going to answer four questions. I have four questions that I've got to answer here. And we've got some some alliterative people that wrote in and wanted to know the answers to some of these questions. So we got Allie from Ashford. Thanks so much for writing me, Allie from Ashford. She wants to know, what is hemoglobin A1C? She said she went to the doctor and her hemoglobin A1C had gone up 0.3 of a point and now it was 6.0, and she was kind of concerned about that. And I asked her what her blood sugar was, her fasting blood sugar, and her fasting blood sugar was 100. So she wanted to know, is she in any danger? What is hemoglobin A1C? Should she be concerned about it? And should she get it back down? Which is a great question. So,
what does it all mean?
Right. I know, right? So hemoglobin A1C is an important measure, and it's a measurement of how we determine what your entry level into the world of diabetes is. When you hit 6.0, you're in that zone of diabetes to pre-diabetes. Right now, depending on the lab that you use, the reference range for hemoglobin A1C, saying that it's abnormal, it'll be flagged for abnormal if it's 5.7 or above. So what does that number even mean? Okay, so we have to backtrack a little bit. First of all, what's the problem with diabetes? What's the hot problem with high blood sugar? So you want your blood sugar to be at a reasonable level. You can't have zero blood sugar because your body, every cell in your body needs sugar to function. Your brain especially needs sugar to function. So you have to have some sugar in your blood. If you have very low blood sugar, you're not going to be able to function well. Your body's not going to like it. It drops below a certain threshold and your body becomes very stressed. And people who are diabetic who have too much insulin on board, they know what happens when they go into insulin shock. And you literally go into shock. Shock is a word that means your body feels like it's in crisis and it will make you faint. It will make you pass out so that you'll lie down and it'll use gravity to get blood to important places in your body, including your brain. When you're standing up, it's harder to get blood to your brain. So if you're down, you're going to get blood to your brain more easily. That is the reason you faint. Did you know that? That is the reason.
Lack of oxygen.
Well, you faint because your body is scared that your brain's not going to get circulation and therefore oxygen. That's right.
Okay.
It's to preserve your brain because your body feels like your brain's not getting enough circulation. That's why you faint. And so if you go into insulin shock, when you go into shock, that's your body taking you down to get circulation and nutrients and sugar also into your brain. Your brain functions on sugar. If you have no sugar in your blood or your blood sugar is low all the time, you will feel cranky and crabby and you won't be able to think straight. So when you have diabetes, you get concerned about your hemoglobin A1C. So what happens with diabetes, it's not so much about the fact that there is sugar in your blood. The problem with sugar, too much sugar being in your blood, is that sugar damages cells. That's the problem. And it's not, so what happens is when you have proteins in your body, proteins are supposed to be soft and supple and they're supposed to slide against each other and then they function the way that they're supposed to. So imagine if you have joints, right? You want your joints to be soft and supple so that they move. When they get brittle or cranky, they can't move well. If your skin gets brittle and cranky, it wrinkles. Other parts of your body do the same thing. So when you get sugar starting to attach to proteins, then your body's not going to work as well, whatever part of it. So in diabetes, the thing that we get the most concerned about is places in your body where you have very little cells. And that tends to be places where you have capillaries. Capillaries are the tiny little blood vessels that connect your arteries and veins, and they tend to be at ends of things. So they tend to be at the ends of your fingers, the ends of your toes, and the big places in your eyes and in your kidneys. You have the glomerulus, which is where you do a lot of filtration of all of your blood in your kidneys, and there's a lot of capillaries there. Likewise, in your eyes, there's tiny little capillaries. The deal with capillaries is they're one cell thick. So if you damage a capillary cell, capillary breaks. Now you don't have circulation. You get enough. Now your body can repair capillaries, but if you have enough capillary damage, you'll get damage to the tissues because it's not getting circulation. So that's a big problem. So having your A1C be at a good level is a marker of this. So what hemoglobin A1C literally is, it is sugar that is attached to hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is a protein that's in your blood, and its job is to carry it carries iron, and it picks up and deposits oxygen into all of the cells of your body. You need oxygen to run the respiration and to run the energy systems of every single cell in your body. So it's hemoglobin's job to run around to all of your body and dump out that oxygen. Hemoglobin is red because it has an iron atom in it, and that's what makes it red. And so hemoglobin can become glycated. So hemoglobin is a protein. Sugar can attach to it, and when sugar is attached to that hemoglobin, it gets a new name, which is hemoglobin A1C. That's what hemoglobin A1C is. The reason that we measure hemoglobin A1C is because it's easy to measure. It's very invasive to do a biopsy of your kidneys or the lens of your eye or your retina to find out if you have glycation there or even your skin. But blood, we take blood out of your veins all the time to test all sorts of stuff. So you can very simply, you send the blood through a flow cytometer and you have machines that can read, oh, look, that hemoglobin's normal. That hemoglobin's A1C. So that number, 5.7, 5.6, 6.0, that's a percentage. That's all it is. It's what percent of your blood is hemoglobin A1C. So we assume that if your hemoglobin A1C is high and climbing, that means there's an unhealthful percentage of other stuff in your body that is also glycated. Yes, it's a problem that your hemoglobin is glycated because you're going to have less hemoglobin to do oxygen exchange. But hemoglobin A1C is a marker. You extrapolate from the idea that your hemoglobin A1C is high to say that you have damage in cells elsewhere in your body. And so it's a flag, a harbinger saying, you got to get your blood sugar down. And so getting your A1C down is actually not as important as getting your blood sugar down. The most important thing is getting it so that you don't have damage to cells in your body. That's really the key. So how do you get your A1C down? You control your blood sugar. How do you control your blood sugar? Well, the chief way to control blood sugar is to stop eating so much of stuff that raises your blood sugar. And then also to get exercise. Exercise is a great way to pull sugar out of your blood because you will use more sugar if you get regular exercise. And quite honestly, the more exercise you get, the more sugar you use. That doesn't mean that you should exercise 24/7, 365. It does mean you should get some exercise. And it is true that the more you get, the more sugar you will burn. Also, the more you get, the more you will stress your, if you get too much exercise, you will stress yourself out. Also, you get into a blood sugar regulation zone if most of your exercise is cardiovascular. If you get mostly cardio exercise and you get into a place where you're stressing your body too much, you raise another hormone called cortisol. And cortisol puts sugar into your blood. And so sometimes we see high-level athletes will have blood sugar regulation problems because if they spend time, a lot of time in cortisol and they're consuming sweet stuff to power their workouts, they might have some blood sugar regulation issues. And that's something you see. You don't tend to see it in professional athletes, but you can see it sometimes in, I shouldn't even say that. That's not even true. Sometimes you will see in professional athletes, they'll have blood sugar regulation issues. And it's a stress issue because they're working themselves so often, so hard, and they're spending so much time in high cortisol. Cortisol is your fight or flight hormone that's made by your adrenals. And cortisol responds to low blood sugar. It comes out when you have a stress to your body, and when your body senses that your blood sugar is dropping too low, and its job is to put sugar into your blood so that you can run away from that bear. But of course, if you're running in a triathlon, that cortisol is going to be high the whole time, and it's going to be constantly putting sugar into your blood, and it's going to find it wherever it can. The other interesting thing that your body does when you're an athlete or when you're exercising so much that you have burned up all your food, it does something called gluconeogenesis, which means making new sugar, making new glucose, and it'll make it from anything, including protein, which is why people who do a lot of really high-level activity have to eat protein. They have to do resistance training because you consume protein when you're doing a lot of cardio exercise. You consume protein when you do any cardio exercise, which is one of the reasons we tell you to consume protein within half an hour of a workout. But anyway, if you're an average person and your doctor has told you your hemoglobin A1C is too high, you have to look at how much exercise you're getting. If you're not getting any, you have to get some. And so there's many reasons why people get none to very little. And I'm trying to find strategies all the time that help people to get more exercise. If you were a person that didn't exercise and then you found some strategies to get some small amounts of exercise into your day, I'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to call in, you can call us now at 860-486-9487. You can text us at that same number, 860-486-9487. Or I'd love to hear from you at radionaturopath@gmail.com. That's radionaturopath@gmail.com. Write in and tell me how you fit exercise into your life when it was difficult before. I'd love to hear it. Okay, so here's some ways you can do that. One of the things that we find, that some quick hacks to help lower your A1C and your blood sugar, is to get some exercise. So remember that getting exercise doesn't have to be, all right, I have to put on exercise clothes and I have to go for a workout, and the workout has to be at least half an hour in length. And because I don't have that half hour, it's out the window. If that's hard for you, I wouldn't do it. So a few hacks are, one of the things is do it first thing in the day. Do it one of the first things you do in the day, because if you have a busy day, later in the day, it's usually hard to switch gears and get motivated to exercise. Most of the time, I do my exercise first thing in the morning. Because I'm, as much as I am very dedicated to exercise, I'm one of those people, if I don't do it first thing and I have a busy day, it won't happen.
And so, you are not a lover of morning exercise either.
I'm not. No, I mean, and it's not entirely true. Part of the problem there is that is the late nights.
You get home too late, right?
Yeah. And so, I mean, I can get up and exercise. I'm happy to get up and exercise if I've gotten into bed at a reasonable hour. What I'm not a lover of is late nights and early mornings, but I don't know who is. I mean, people who are early birds in part because they go to bed early.
Right.
Their day is shifted in that direction.
Sure.
If your day is shifted in a direction, you know, I function well on 8 to 9 hours of sleep. It's rare that I get it because my life is so busy. So that's part of the problem. It's not that I'm not crazy about the morning exercise. It's I'm not crazy about the morning if the night has been late. And again, I don't know who is. I mean, people I know who get up super early to exercise go to bed early.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. So yeah. that's how that works.
So it's about changing your routine.
Well, it's about
or
it's
fitting
about a
it
shift
into your routine.
Because the thing is, some people have situations where the routine is their routine, and it's very hard for them to change. If they have children, the worst thing I hear is kids in a commute. That's the hardest one. Kids in a commute. If you have both of those things going on, the kids have to be taken. Either they have to be cared for in the morning, put on the bus, dressed, and all that stuff, or they have to be brought to school or wherever they're going to go. They may have activities later in the day or on the weekends, and so the kids have to be chauffeured wherever they're going to be in their lives. So that's part of it. And then if you also have a commute, there's time in your day that's time getting from your house to your job, which if you're in a car doing that, it's the worst thing because you're driving, you're sitting, and you're not
right.
able that's just time that you could be doing so many other things. If you were on a train, you can actually accomplish some stuff. You can learn some stuff. You can play a game. You can relax. You can take naps. But because people drive in cars, I should put it that way. The worst thing is driving in a car as your commute plus having kids, and that's the hardest thing. So that would be the kind of person where I would be fitting in 5 to 10 minutes of exercise bursts throughout the day. So as soon as you get to work, if you're at work before your actual clock in time, that would be a time to do 5 minutes of squats. Can you stand up at your desk? Can you have some exercise balls or bands or something at your desk where you can do 5 minutes of curls? If you have bands, they're really great because you can do so many things with them, and they're not heavy and they're easy to store. I mean, you fold them up and throw them in a drawer, and they're not heavy. They're great. And you can get the kind of bands that are, long, that they look like a big piece of linguine or lasagna noodle, the really big kind,
right.
The really long kind. And you can step on them and do tricep pulls, and you can do biceps, and you can pull them over your heads. You can do presses. There's about a million exercises you can do with those. And then the kinds of bands that you put around your ankles or your legs. You can do Ron's favorite monster walks. Those are great. You can put them around your ankles. You can put them around above your knees. And you can do things for your abductors and adductors. Your legs can get a great workout with those bands. And you don't need a lot of space to access those. So those are good things you can do. And just body weight stuff, squats and hamstring lifts, and there's a lot of things you can do, and you can do them 5 minutes at a time from your desk, and don't even feel like you have to do them all at once. So that's a nice thing to do. Walking, parking far, we talk about, that thing about, it sounds trite because I've said it so many times, but parking far from where you work so that you have to walk to get to your office, parking far every time you go to the store or the mall. Don't try to get the closest space to the store. You'll get some steps in. If you're a Fitbit person, if you're a person who counts your steps with a Fitbit or with an app or, a Garmin or some other, apparatus that counts your steps, you'll get more steps. It's like getting points. So those are ways to fit it in.
And it's kind of amazing because, a lot of the new phones that are out there, they have these things that record your steps without even having to have anything fancy other than have the phone in your pocket.
Right.
And when you look at it at the end of the day and you go, wow, I walked 4,000 steps today. That's interesting.
Uh-huh.
And that could just be in the course of the day.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And in the course of a day, that certainly could happen. Yes, there's apps. I have a few favorite apps. If you have an iPhone, you can use Apple Health. If you have an Android phone, you can use Google Fit. There's many other apps where you don't even have to have the apparatus. You don't have to have the Fitbit. Nice thing about the Fitbit is you don't have to carry your phone. And then it will sync with your phone. There's a Fitbit app, it could be Fitbit, it could be Garmin. There's a Jawbone. There's there's many brands now of these exercise trackers. And they generally have apps associated with them, and they have Bluetooth capability. So when you get near your phone, if the Bluetooth is on, it'll sync with your phone. You can hand sync as well, and you can sync with your computer as well. If your computer has a Bluetooth, which many newer laptops do, it'll sync as soon as you get near your computer. And if it doesn't, they have USB capability, and you can plug them into your computer, and they'll upload that way. So the great thing about that is tracking, and tracking. Tracking is motivating. You feel like you're playing a video game and you're getting points. It's very cool. So exercise. The other thing about exercise is what I try to tell people, I beg people to do this, is one day go long. One day go long.
Yep.
And long, how long is long? Long is as long as you can manage. If you are not exercising at all, for you, half an hour may be long. At what intensity should you go long? The answer, it doesn't matter. Okay, so your day to go long. And when I go long on the weekend, my intensity is not supposed to matter. So when I do a long ride, I don't worry about how intensely I'm going. If I'm taking your spin class on Sundays, I'll take the class, but the rest of the time in the saddle is going to be easy time in the saddle. It's just time in the saddle. And so for you, go long means doing something at a low to moderate intensity for as long as you can manage. And that might be 30, if you're not exercising at all, it might be 30 minutes. If you're doing 30 minute walks, maybe an hour. If you're doing hour walks, then 2 hours, but longer than any other day of the week. And it should be a little bit, the time should be a little bit challenging. The intensity does not have to be. And if making the intensity too much is going to make you less likely to do it, you're doing it too intensely, back the intensity down. Go for a 2 hour stroll. A 2 hour stroll once a week can lower your blood sugar and your A1C. It's been studied. All right. The other thing that's an easy hack to help lower blood sugar and A1C is about food. And we've talked about this before. It's been studied that if you were a carb eater, to fill up on protein and vegetables in the beginning of your meal and eat whatever carb you're going to eat at the end of the meal, because the protein and vegetables have already blunted your blood sugar response. And when you eat the carbs, the carbs, because there's protein and fat and fiber in your stomach already, the sugar and starch can't possibly absorb as quickly as the fat and fiber, or it can't possibly absorb as quickly because of the presence of protein, fat, and fiber. So your blood sugar can't spike in the same way, and you can lower your blood sugar and your A1C several points by doing that. So that's a really good thing. Then you have to look at how much starch and sugar you're eating in the first place. Reconsider modern wheat, because it does have amylopectin A, which raises your blood sugar a lot. If you're eating a lot of modern wheat, at least think about cutting back or doing what I said, which is to eat it at the end of your meal. If you're having two pieces of toast in the morning, maybe have one and have more protein and vegetables. And if you're eating starchy food throughout the day, if you're doing the cereal for breakfast, sandwiches for lunch, and pasta for dinner, you have to rethink that. You need to be eating more protein, vegetables, fruit, nuts, and seeds throughout the day. And one of the things we see is that people eat too much starchy food.
So that means that, backing up now, the caller or the person who wrote into you gave you some numbers.
Right.
Are they good? Are they bad? Are they,
right.
You know, where do those numbers stand as far as the scheme of things go?
Okay. So when you look, the most conservative reference range that I have seen is 5.7. So the most stingy labs will tell you, if you're at 5.7, we're going to flag you. We're going to tell you need to start thinking about your hemoglobin A1C. Now, if you look at Dr. Mercola, Joseph Mercola, he wants to see you below 5. It is rare that I see anybody below 5. And yet, we're not supposed to diagnose people with prediabetes until they're at 5.7. But it is very rare for me to see people below 5.
So 5.7 is the magic number for
5.7 is the reference range that was set by someone, maybe the American Diabetes Association. I don't know. But not not all labs have that as the reference range. A lot of labs won't flag till 6.0. So anyway, if you're at 6, you got a blood sugar issue. Whether you're diabetic or pre-diabetic is up for debate. That would also depend on what your actual blood sugar is. But you shouldn't be sitting at 6.0. 6.0 for me is an uh-oh. It's not an extreme uh-oh, but it is like your blood sugar is too high. Your A1C is too high.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it says here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not good. You don't want to see somewhere in the range. Normal A1 range is between 4 and 6%. But when you get up to 6%, now you're in pre-diabetes.
Definitely right. Pre-diabetes. Some would even say diabetes. So are there supplements that can help you to lower your A1C? Yes. I must preface this by saying, what's the best thing to lower your blood sugar and A1C? Diet, exercise, and stress reduction. That's it, okay? Those are the number one treatments for type 2 diabetes, for blood sugar issues, for lowering your hemoglobin A1C. So you can take supplements and eat, you can take supplements if you want to. They don't work as well as you changing your diet. They will help you, and they'll help you get down further. But you can't rely on supplements to help you get your A1C down alone. If you're going to not exercise and you can continue to eat starch and sugar, you may go from 7 to 6.8, but that's not doing very much.
Are there people that are predisposed to high A1C?
Yeah, there's a genetic predisposition to type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So definitely.
So what if they're otherwise healthy, would they run into this problem or not?
If your A1C is high, it's almost always because there's something wrong.
Okay.
That you're doing something that's making it high. So you have a genetic predisposition to high. You're not going to have high A1C. You don't just make hemoglobin A1C.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to find out.
There has to be. No, hemoglobin A1C is not something you make genetically. What you make genetically is hemoglobin. The sugar comes from outside, from when you eat.
Okay.
Gets into your body.
So it's all self-inflicted, so
yeah,
to speak.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. You could make a case. I'm not sure if there's any kind of a condition where there may be some rare genetic conditions, and if somebody knows about this, let me know. Could be a rare genetic condition where you do too much gluconeogenesis, where you have I could imagine that there's a genetic anomaly where you have some kind of enzymatic defect where your body goes after your tissue and eats your protein, but I don't know how compatible with life that would be. Like, how would if a person would last? It's like there's a genetic condition where you consume your protein, all the protein in your body, and you make sugar out of it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a genetic condition, but that's exceedingly rare. Most people who walk into my office, their A1C is high because they're not exercising enough and they're eating too much starch and sugar. It is rare for me to see, like I said, it's very rare for me to see a person below 5. And I do see it sometimes. And when I see it, I cheer for the person if I see somebody in the 4s. Once in a while, you get somebody come in and their A1C is 4.6 to 4.9. The only reason I know that is because I check everyone's. And not everybody does that. So if your doctor doesn't routinely check hemoglobin A1C, you won't know what yours is.
So you should always ask.
Yeah, you should always ask. A naturopath is generally going to check it. So supplements that can help your A1C. There are a few. I like to talk about berberines. Berberines is a really good one. And berberines is they're extracts of things from the Berberaceae family. Berberaceae family includes things like golden seal, golden thread or coptis, Mahonia or Oregon grape, Mahonia and Oregon grape, because there's Mahonia, there's Berberis aquifolia and Berberis vulgaris, and one is Mahonia and one's Oregon grape. Anyway, they all have berberines in them. Berberines are this bright, bilious yellow color, and they are great, but they're stimulating to your liver. They help to heal your liver. They help to move bile and help you to produce bile, and they also help with glycogen metabolism in your liver, and therefore they help to reduce your hemoglobin A1C. So that's their mechanism. Other things we like to help with reducing hemoglobin A1C would be your anthocyanins, and those are going to be your beautifully colored berries and cherries. So there are anthocyanins and cherries. People talk about using tart cherry all the time for reducing inflammation, and it does work, but would you believe there are more antioxidants and anthocyanins in Bing cherries, just your good old black cherries that you get from Washington State. Those are full of proanthocyanins. What else? Blueberries, bilberry or huckleberries, blackberries, raspberries, strawberries, all of your dark berries. Okay. Grapes have resveratrol in them and also anthocyanins. Grape seeds and grape seed extract has anthocyanins in it. They're terrific antioxidants. Another one is acai. And acai, people get all excited about the acai. My Brazilian friends laugh that acai became a superfood in the United States that you pay a lot of money for, because acai is a dime a dozen down in Brazil. And it is high in proanthocyanins. So if you want to do acai pills, that's great. If you want to get drinks with acai in it, knock yourself out. I have to point out that good old boring Maine blueberries, or blueberries that grow in your backyard, are full of proanthocyanins. And there's another one called Aronia. Aronia, and I'm not speaking erroneously, but there's Aronia berry, which is kind of bitter, but it's wicked high in antioxidants. Another one that's not so local, but is full of proanthocyanins and also ellagic acid, which is really good for cardiovascular health, is pomegranates. So pomegranate juice and pomegranates are really great for helping your A1C, as well as, I said pomegranates and all the berries, acai, grape seed, also pine bark extract. And pine bark extract is expensive, but it does have a lot of proanthocyanins in it. And there are good studies that show if you take 200 milligrams of pine bark extract, also known as pycnogenol, per day, you can lower your hemoglobin A1C. It's expensive. And you'd be better off just doing good old grape seed extract, which is less expensive, eating your berries and cherries, and getting your exercise and reducing your starch and sugar.
So, anyway, Ellen just called from Stores.
Yeah.
Avid listener, loves the show. Yay. Thank you. Shout out to Ellen. Very nice. She said you might want to mention something about certain drugs that affect things. There's one called Soma, which is apparently a muscle relaxer.
Erythropoietin. Yeah,
and,
sure.
And, mm-hmm. Yeah, and she had some trouble with that. So you might want to mention drugs that might possibly cause problems.
Problems with what?
Blood sugar, yes.
Oh, that is something I didn't know, that carisoprodol can cause blood sugar issues. That is news to me. It doesn't mean it isn't true. It means I didn't know about that. Because did you know that I don't know everything? One day somebody said to me, Fran, you know everything. And I'm like, nuh-uh. So I am... That is not something I know about, and something I'm going to have to look into, that it can cause blood sugar dysregulation. So if I can find something about it before the end of the show, I will let you know about that. But it's not something because I'd be interested in to know what the mechanism of action of that is. And the other thing is that I'm looking here at a list of side effects and I'm not seeing it. So if there's some resource regarding this drug, carisoprodol, also known as Soma, causing blood sugar issues, I would love to know about it. Okay, so that's so that was really good. So thanks to Allie from Ashford for giving me a good topic to discuss. Now we want to talk about... a question from Gail from Glastonbury, and she wanted to know about gallstones. She's concerned because she had an ultrasound. She had some pain in her right upper quadrant of her abdomen. So everybody, check her out. If you're driving, don't do this. But if you're not driving and you're still, check your abdomen. You have this abdomen, all right? The abdomen starts just below your breasts and goes down to just above your pubic bone, and it's a big square. That's your abdomen, okay? Right smack in the middle of your abdomen is your navel, also known as your belly button. All right. So around that, so if you go, on the right, hold up your right hand, not if you're driving, hold up your right hand and put it on just below your nipple or breast, okay? That is where your liver is. On top and slightly behind your liver is your gallbladder. So your liver has a bazillion functions. It's, and I had a wonderful professor, Dr. Titrid, and he was a chiropractor, but he was very, very versed in anatomy, and he was our anatomy professor at the National College of Naturopathic Medicine. May he rest in peace. Anyway, so Dr. Titrid gave us so many mnemonics and so many funny things to think about, but I never forgot him. So obviously his tutelage was effective. So his he taught us about the liver, and he thought that letters should not be signed, love, Fran. He thought letters should be signed, hepatically yours, Fran, because he thought the liver was the most important organ in the body. The liver is very large. It takes up most of your abdomen. The cool thing about the liver is it can regenerate itself. The thing about the liver is it does so many things that it can get damaged, and all of your blood goes through it, and then your liver tries to make sense of all the things you're sending through it. So you can hurt your liver. So the liver, if you look at the liver, if you take a sample of liver, the whole liver looks homogeneous. All the cells look exactly the same. The crazy thing about those cells is they do about a million things. I'm exaggerating, but they do a lot of stuff. Each liver cell is capable of doing all of the same things that all the other liver cells are capable of doing, which includes metabolizing fat, metabolizing sugar, turning sugar into glycogen for storage, managing your vitamin B12, producing bile, sending bile through, detoxifying different kinds of chemicals in your body, metabolizing different kinds of chemicals in your body, producing fats in a usable form like cholesterol. It has so many different functions. So you have this other organ called the gallbladder. So like we said, one of the things is that the liver produces this substance called bile. Bile is a very important substance. Bile is, it's the river. So if you think about the liver cells itself as being the factories, right? They're the factories. They're the place where stuff is produced, stuff is metabolized, stuff is dumped out. Well, you've got to have a way to carry that stuff, the products of the factory, out of the factory. So you've got these rivers and lakes and these canals, and the canals are called caniculi. And so your liver produces bile. Bile is the fluid that's in all those lakes and rivers and canals and carries all this good stuff and bad stuff out of your liver or through your liver or to wherever it's going to get going. So bile gets colored eventually with the breakdown products of red blood cells. Red blood cells are broken down in the spleen and the liver. And the breakdown product of red blood cells, specifically hemoglobin, is bilirubin. So the bilirubin will color your bile. And so when you lose bile, when you lose bile in your stool, which is normal, it colors your stool. If you have a blockage in your liver, in your biliary system, anywhere in your biliary system, you will have a clay-colored or white stool, because the reason your stool is brown or reddish brown or dark brown, in part it's because of whatever you ate, but mostly it's because of bilirubin, the breakdown product of hemoglobin. So anyway, what the heck are gallstones? First of all, what's a gallbladder? Gallbladder is this little, when you talk about a bladder, a bladder, just a generic bladder, is just an empty sack or a sack that has space inside it. So your urinary bladder is an empty sack, or it's a sack that it has potential of being filled, I should say, and it gets filled with urine until you urinate, and then the urine comes out. If you go to the beach and you see seaweed, that's called bladder rack. It's called bladder rack because it's wrecked with bladders. And so you pick up the bladder rack, and it has these little bubbles all over it, and they're little pockets that can fill with air. And I think, I don't know why the goddess decided to make bladder rack like that. I'm just assuming it makes it so it's an advantage to the seaweed to make it float better, I guess, because it can take up gas bubbles and make it more floaty. And the more floaty it is, the more it can rise to the surface of the water and the more sunlight it's going to get. And then it can do more metabolism, including photosynthesis. And so anyway, so you have, so a gallbladder is a bladder that holds gall. And gall is another word for bile. And back in the day, when people used to talk about the humors, they used to talk about the humors, the fluids of the body in a very rudimentary way. And gall was one of the things they talked about.
Why did they call them humors?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure what the root of the use of humors for bodily fluids is. But there's an etymology that I'm not aware of. You can look that up if you want to. But they used to call them the humors. And I think that that's the original word. You know, when you say a sense of humor, and that when you have a sense of humor or you're good-humored or ill-humored, it's referring back to the use of humors as these basic fluids, because these basic fluids affected how your emotions worked. Go ahead.
It goes back to ancient Egypt and Hippocrates.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. He developed it into medical theory. He believed certain human moods, emotions, and behaviors were caused by an excess or lack of body fluids called humors.
Yes, humors, right.
There you go.
Right. So the idea of good humored or ill humored or sense of humor comes from that.
Okay.
Because if your body fluids were off, your humors were off, and that affected your mood. So we extended that into English to talk about, you know, your sense of humor not being a body fluid, but just, you know, how you, an emotional state.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So anyway, gall is one of the humors, and gall is another word for bile. And so the gallbladder holds bile. And so what it is it's a storage facility. So when your liver makes bile, you have this little bladder called the gallbladder that will store bile for you, and it just sends some bile into this gallbladder. And the gallbladder is an acute storage facility. So it will squirt out bile when you need it, when you eat fatty food, because you need bile to help emulsify the fats in your food.
That's what it's for.
Yeah, that's what it's for. So the thing is, stuff goes through that gallbladder. You want your bile to be thin, and your bile will thicken up if you eat too much junk.
So if you eat a lot of junk, then you're going to have problems with your gallbladder?
Yeah, if you eat too much starch and sugar, and if you eat too much poor quality fat, your bile gets thick.
So if you eat the classic diet of
you're more likely to have gallbladder problems. So what's a gallstone?
Wonderful.
So the classic, so there can be a number of kinds of gallstones. So there's gallstones that are just your classic poor quality diet and lifestyle gallstone. And then there's other kinds of gallstones where people, you know, have a genetic or a congenital biliary issue where they make poor quality biliary stones, and they can get a different kind of gallstone. But the classic gallstones from poor quality diet by eating too much saturated and hydrogenated fat, from eating too much starch and sugar, from having too much inflammation in the body, they're made of cholesterol, calcium, and bile salts. So if you increase the amount of bile salts and you thin bile, you're not going to be as prone to gallstones, and you may be able to dissolve gallstones. You may get to a point where the gallstones are so large and so intact that you're not going to be able to dissolve them.
Ew.
But
you have to have them surgically removed?
That's what people do. They have them removed. So here's the problem. Gallstones they often form as a result of inflammation, because if you're sending through a lot of poor quality food, you're more likely to be inflamed. The more likely you are to be inflamed, the more likely you are to have unfriendly bacteria in your system. And the unfriendly bacteria is going to cause irritation and inflammation. So the gallbladder can become irritated and inflamed. And when it does that, your body is going to want to protect you from it. One of the things your body does to protect you is it sends calcium to an area and creates calcifications. So your body will calcify around that rest of inflammation. And then it will also send, because you don't want just little rocks of calcium, your body will also protect you by sticking bile salts into that structure, as well as cholesterol. So you have this waxy, hardish substance that sits in your gallbladder, and it can block the gallbladder up. If there's enough inflammation, it can cause inflammation. So you can have just the presence of gallstones, and then you can have what we call cholecystitis. So cholecyst is the Greek word for the gallbladder. Cholecystitis is an inflamed gallbladder. Cholelithiasis is a gallbladder that has stones in it, because lith is a stone in Greek.
So can you pass these stones? Can they?
Yes, you can pass them.
So
you don't always, but you
can.
And
where do they go?
Well, the gallbladder is attached to your digestive system.
Okay.
It's attached to the pancreatic ducts, which is then attached to your small intestine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a ductal system. So the liver and the gallbladder and the pancreas are exocrine glands. And their exocrine glands are glands that produce stuff that goes to other places via ducts.
Okay.
As opposed to endocrine glands that dump directly into the blood.
So they go out through your feces?
Eventually.
Okay.
Eventually, that is correct. Eventually, mm-hmm. they will. You can excrete them that way. One of the things you can try to do is thin your bile enough so that the gallbladders fall apart. It's not correct to say that they dissolve, because dissolve is something that happens to compounds in water, in watery substances. Whereas we're talking about bile and you're talking about fats. And when you talk about one fat dispersing itself into small particles into another fat, that the proper term to use is emulsification. In fact, a fat can emulsify in a liquid, in water and other liquids. But what fat does, emulsification is not the same as dissolving. Dissolving is the molecules, or you're going down to the level of a molecule or even an atom. That's what dissolving is. Emulsification is when a fat gets into very, very tiny particles, but it's not to the level of a molecule. So bile emulsifies fats. And if you can get enough, your bile thin enough and emulsify it enough, you can start to break down those gallstones. Yes, go ahead.
So how does one thin one's bile?
Right. Okay, so how do you thin your bile? Again, guess what? You have to not be inflamed. Inflammation causes thickening. Think of that as a general principle in your body. It causes thickening in your body. That's not always a bad thing, because if you want your bicep muscle to get thick, guess what? You're inflaming it.
Sure.
There's an inflammatory process that happens in the process of muscle hypertrophy. So inflammation is a necessary thing. So when you have inflammation, in your body, you're going to have thicker bile. You're going to have thicker blood.
Mm-hmm.
When you have thicker blood, you get more clots, and more clots can be dangerous.
Good.
Yes.
That's
so you
good.
Want your blood to be a little on the thin side, not too thin, because then you bleed too much.
Right.
But if you're on the thicker side, then you can get more inflammation. So you thin your bile. The way you thin your bile is by deflaming.
Mm-hmm.
By not eating so much inflammatory food. Guess what? Starch, sugar, processed food.
Here we go again.
Poor quality fat. So if you eat a lot of deep fried food, you're going to be more likely to have gallstones. When we look at people with gallstones, one of the things we talk about is the four Fs. It's female fat, 40-ish, and fertile. So if you have a weight issue and you're fertile, so apparently there's some connection with estrogen, increasing the likelihood of gallstones, because estrogen causes growth. So it makes you more coagulable. It is going to thicken your bile. So you thin bile by eating healthfully, eating, guess what, fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, clean protein, less starch and sugar. And when you get to the point where you're having fat problems with your fat system, you may actually, even though we'd say saturated fat doesn't really raise your cholesterol much, and that it's not dangerous, it doesn't really cause inflammation, saturated fat may be hard to digest if you have biliary issues. So that's a point where you have to figure out, can I eat butter? Can I eat coconut oil? Can I eat healthy saturated fats? You may or may not be able to. People with gallstones tend to do okay with things like flaxseed oil, hemp oil, monounsaturated and polyunsaturated oils. They tend to do okay with those things. I've given people flaxseed oil and olive oil, and they do fine on those, and it doesn't cause what we call biliary colic, colic where you have pain in your upper abdomen because you your gallbladder is contracting. The thing about having an inflamed gallbladder is that it'll contract. You may, when you have gallstones, even if you don't have inflammation, if there are gallstones in there, your gallbladder is going to contract every time you eat most food, especially food that has any fat in it. So if it's contracting around stones, it's going to hurt most of the time when you eat, just because it's contracting around a substance. It's not empty. So you thin your bile by eating healthfully. You can eat fish oil. You can eat fish as long as it's not deep fried. Olive oil. In fact, healthy fats help to thin your bile. So we give people fish oil. We give people sometimes flaxseed oil or hemp oil as long as they're not rancid. If they're rancid, you're working across purposes because then you're causing more damage and inflammation. We may give people bile salts or we might just give them straight up bile. Doctors will give ursodiol, which is ursodiol means bear bile. And it used to be extracted from bears, but it's not anymore. But you can get ox bile. That is something you can get as a supplement. And it does come from oxen because, you know, oxen are used for other things. They're used for their meat. And so if you take their liver and their gallbladder, you can extract the bile from it and use that as a supplement. So you can also use taurine. The amino acid taurine is a thins bile. So people come in with gallbladder stuff. I'll generally put them on fish oil. I might put them on flax or hemp oil. I will tend to put them on a lower saturated fat diet and a no hydrogenated fats and lower sugar and carbs. The other thing you should know is that you can get gallstones from losing weight too fast. And that people, or just by losing large amounts of weight. So people who go on diets who are, you know, who are quite obese and they have a lot of weight to lose, 50, 100 pounds. If you lose it too fast, you can get gallstones from that. So you have to be careful not to lose weight too fast. And sometimes even if you're very heavy, and then you go on a really good clean diet, you can lose weight very quickly and you are in danger of getting gallstones. So somebody who's, losing weight and has a lot of weight to lose, I might consider prophylactically putting them on stuff to thin their bile. So fish oil, those good oils, sometimes then certain herbs like artichoke. I might not do milk thistle because it pushes the bile too much. You have to be careful with cholagogues and choleretics, things that produce bile and that push the bile too much because that can cause discomfort. So that's why you tend to stick to the oils, the ox bile, and things like artichoke, gentler things like artichoke. You can also use homeopathic remedies like chelidonium is a good one for right upper quadrant pain. So those are ways that I help people with gallstones. Now, if somebody has a really bad attack and they're in a lot of pain, they're in danger, unfortunately, of having that inflamed gallbladder rupture, just like if you have appendicitis. So unfortunately, if it goes too far, the gallbladder is often taken, and people can live healthy lives without a gallbladder, but they have to be really careful because now you don't have that storage facility to manage the level of bile that's going to be secreted into your digestive system. So you have to be careful. You really have to be careful about your starches and sugars and your unhealthy fats. So so those all can be issues. So so sometimes it's necessary to have that gallbladder removed, and then you have to take care of your biliary system in a really good way. So that's great. So we had two great questions. That was so thanks to Gail from Glastonbury for writing that one in. Next week, we'd love to get more questions from you. We'll see if we can get to all four. We only got to two today, and that's great. So A1C and gallstones, that's been Radio Naturopath for the day.
Yeah, keep them coming. Yeah, it's great.
Keep the questions coming.
Right.
Remember, you can call us. It's 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can text us. You can also write me at any time at radionaturopath@gmail.com. We encourage you to go on Facebook to Fran Storch ND, naturopathic physician, radio naturopath. You can also look at my website, franstorchnd.com. And you can also go to whus.org and listen to any podcast of this show at any time. So if you missed some of this show today, it will be up within a week and you'll be able to listen to the whole thing at your leisure at whus.org as well as on iTunes. All right. So do you have any more questions for me?
That's like the beauty of modern technology.
Yeah.
It's really a wonderful thing.
Yes.
No, actually, we have some things we can discuss next week. I had a caller that was looking to pick your brain about the benefits of goji, noni, and mangosteen.
Goji, noni, and mangosteen.
We'll deal with that next week because I'll bet there's probably a long explanation.
You know why that person asked me that question? Because I said acai. I bet you anything.
Could be.
It's because of the acai, because acai is one of those super fruits that gets multi-level marketed.
Yeah,
and those
okay.
three guys, goji, noni, and mangosteen, also get multi-level. My favorite of the three is goji.
I know. We have goji berries at the house.
Goji tastes very good, and they're easy to get, and they're wonderful. They're full of antioxidants, and they're immune tonics, and you can use them instead of or in addition to raisins in your oatmeal or anywhere you would use raisins. You put them in the salad. You can just eat them as a snack. They go great in a trail mix. They go great with chocolate. You can get chocolate-covered goji berries. You can just eat them straight. They're lovely. Anyway. All right. I'm going to go.
So, anyway, we have some more things we can discuss next week. For sure.
You've been listening to Radio Naturopath here on 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. I have been Fran Storch, and I probably still will be next week. And you can hear more Radio Naturopath here on 91.7 FM WHUS.